Hi everyone, you're listening to Like Her, the podcast that celebrates women doing fantastic things in the realms of beauty, fitness, wellness, and everything else in between. Like Her is a space for women to share their ideas, have honest conversations, and most importantly, have a good laugh. I'm Rosanna, and each episode I'll be speaking to an inspiring woman that will hopefully make you think, I like her. So on that note, get yourself comfy, get yourself a nice drink, and enjoy the episode. Hi everyone, welcome to the fifth episode of the Like Her podcast. Today I've got a really special guest, Renee McGregor, who is a dietitian stroke nutritionist. She's worked with Paralympic athletes, and she's recently been voted as a top five wellness warrior, which was a complete surprise to her.
Absolutely.
So thank you for joining me today. Welcome, and we're just going to be talking about the best thing in life, which is food.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So we've had lots of questions through Instagram, so I think this is going to be a bit of a Q&A thing. But before we start the questions, do you want to just introduce yourself, because you know a bit more about yourself and what you do than I do, and explain what you do to everyone?
Sure. I am a sports and eating disorder specialist dietitian. So I started life out as a clinical dietitian working in the NHS for about 7 years, and then in sort of 2010 I started working more specifically in sport. So I did a postgrad in applied sports nutrition on top of my dietetics degree and biochemistry degree. I just thought, you know, I need a bit more
stress in your life.
Exactly. And so then since 2010 I've worked mainly in the area of sports nutrition. But interestingly, because of my clinical background, I've ended up using quite a lot of that knowledge, and believe it or not, there's a very big overlap with disordered eating, eating disorders, overtraining, exercise addiction within sport. And I found that my knowledge in that field actually made me somebody that could really make a difference.
Yeah.
So more recently, I guess since Rio, I went out to Rio with wheelchair fencing and wheelchair basketball, which was incredible. It was an amazing experience to go out to a Paralympic Games and experience just being there, and being part of a team, and obviously medal winning teams as well. But I came back and I was like, what do I really want to do? Like, I'd done London and I'd done Rio, and I really wasn't sure I wanted to work towards another Olympic or Paralympic cycle. And I guess fundamentally I really like to make a difference.
Yeah.
And while, yes, you make a difference in sport, I was starting to get to the point where I found it very, very difficult just pursuing performance, because I could see that if we just pursue performance, you start to, you don't always look after your health and your resilience, so you're neglecting those areas of your life that you almost need to get good performance.
Yeah.
And I was finding that quite a tough environment to work in. I mean, sport's great, but it's quite brutal.
Yeah.
You know? And what I was finding was that more and more individual athletes from different sports were coming to me with real specific eating disorder problems, but they wanted somebody that understood sport. So it's very different to just having an eating disorder. When you're an athlete with an eating disorder, there's quite a lot of difficulties in that in itself.
Yeah.
And in fact, if you look at studies, it does show that people who've got an exercise addiction, it's much harder to recover from an eating disorder than without. And so I found that I was making a difference. And I suppose that's where I'm sitting now, in that I'm basically working independently, but I work with a lot of different national governing bodies. I still work for Scottish Gymnastics, and I'm on the team management for the Great Britain 24-hour running team. And I work with lots of individual athletes, but my main focus is probably looking at energy availability, eating disorders in sport. And obviously that's why we created the Train Brave campaign as well, which is to raise awareness of eating disorders in sport. So yeah, I mean, I guess I do a bit of everything.
But your main thing is that you do actually work as a dietitian.
Yes, I have.
In a clinic.
Yes, I have a very, very heavy clinical workload. I mean, even just in the last, I was talking to a friend this morning and he said, you look knackered. I was like, oh, thanks. And I was like, I literally, the last 2 weeks, I have probably seen in the region of about 20 people.
Mm.
And it's exhausting.
Yeah.
So yeah, that on top of trying to keep some sort of presence on social media, which, you know, like, seriously, I have no idea how I got that label as a wellness warrior. Like, it's very, I'm very honoured.
Yeah.
But it's not why I do Instagram.
Yeah.
I do Instagram because I want to get a message out there.
It's like an offset of what you're already doing, really, isn't it? Rather than the other way around.
Yeah, and I appreciate that not everybody can access me.
Mm.
But one, I'm actually busy in the sense that my clinic is quite full.
Mm.
But two, also, not everybody can afford private, and I have to, unfortunately, have a private service because it's not available on the NHS, and I can't get it to be available on the NHS. So, and I've got bills to pay. I'm a single mum. So, you know, it's like I have to do it that way. And I guess because I do care so much, I want people to understand why they develop these coping mechanisms, because that's what an eating disorder is, right? Or overtraining. It's a coping mechanism when life feels really difficult. And so it's about helping them to understand that. And that's what I tend to use Instagram for,
than
anything else.
So I can't remember if I introduced you by saying that you have written 4 books.
Yes.
And the one that I kind of know you for is Orthorexia, which I've almost finished. I've almost done it in like a week, and it is really interesting. The thing for me when I started reading it was, and it's kind of what you've just brought up as well, is with athletes and people that exercise, what is the line between discipline and disorder?
It's a really good question.
Because I feel like to be, and I think this is maybe because I used to be sporty when I was younger, but I've never had an eating disorder. But there's definitely a personality trait, which is like competitive, a bit of a perfectionist, and you want to do well, which also a lot of people with eating disorders tend to have those traits as well. So how, what's the difference between somebody that's very disciplined with their exercise and their eating and then somebody who's got disordered eating?
Really good question. And I think the main thing is that, yes, to be an athlete, especially at a high level, or even not, I mean, I would say I'm fairly disciplined with my training, but you do tend to be a certain type of personality. So yes, you said it, right, perfectionist, driven, ambitious, probably quite sensitive at times, very self-critical. Now, the fine line is that those are the traits that that obviously get you success, but they're equally the traits that can be your Achilles heel.
Yeah.
So as soon as it starts to become something that is negating your health or creates anxiety, I feel like that's when it becomes something dysfunctional and disordered. So, you know, I see a lot of people that are pursuing performance and they will go to an extreme. So when you have an extreme behavior, you tend to also have other extreme behaviors, and we know that. So the common one is, I want to be the best at my sport. And we keep hearing it, even though there's not really any evidence for it, but the lighter you are, the faster you are, the lighter you are, the better you are.
Yeah.
Apparently. And so people go in search of that. Instead of looking at their training load or their lifestyle, or like just things that you could make a difference on, like, for example, sleep is so important for your recovery. And, you know, especially like a lot of athletes, it normally, you start being an athlete quite young and you might do it through uni. So you're then, you know, combining that with your academic study. I mean, I had a very, very good athlete in clinic just this week, and she potentially could be chosen for the GB mountain running team. But she's doing veterinary science. So, I mean, her academic...
But again, it's the same personality type, isn't it?
Exactly.
It's the achiever and the people that want to do well.
Yeah. And I guess what happens is it almost feels like an easy thing to look at your food to start with, if that makes sense. It becomes a lot easier to think, well, if I just drop a kilo or two, it will make a difference to my performance. But unfortunately, again, because of that obsessive nature, and usually these individuals are already on the lean side, so they drop a kilo to the point where their brain becomes affected and they start becoming quite irrational and become more compulsive. And I think as soon as food becomes a problem, like when you notice you can't go out to social events. You right. can't be spontaneous.
Then that's...
You stop giving up.
But
those
do you
things.
Think these individuals know that when they're going through it?
I think they do eventually.
Yeah.
Yeah. And not maybe not immediately, but again, and it's so easy to use. But I'm an athlete as a disguise.
Yeah.
And that's the bit where it's difficult. But even
especially if they're good at it, because I don't know if you come from a family where your parents aren't athletes, but you are, you've got the one up on them. And they're going to be ignorant to it anyway. So yeah. they'll be like, well, she's an athlete. Okay, fine. She knows what she's doing. Yeah. So I guess it's that thing as well. So are there any other behaviours apart from the sort of changing the food that happens when it turns over from discipline to disorder?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, a hungry body is not a healthy body.
Mm.
So you become irritable. You become withdrawn. You become more obsessive. You may even find that you take it out on more kind of OCD type behaviours, like you might become very obsessed with being clean or,
yeah.
you know, like I have had athletes who are really worried about turning lights off.
Yeah.
And they've not been like that before, but it's that obsessiveness that comes through. You probably find yourself getting really low because
yeah.
one of the things about underfueling, now you don't necessarily have to lose weight, and I think that's really important, but the thing about underfueling is that it affects your hormonal balance.
Mm.
So, you know, we talk in sport, we talk about REDS, which is relative energy deficiency in sport. And it can be something that athletes are just not aware of. So it can be something that's completely and utterly involuntary in that they just don't appreciate how much fuel they need.
Mm.
But in those cases, they often pick up on it quite quickly. Like they notice
yeah.
they're not recovering very well or their performance is starting to alter.
And it is about the sport rather than
yeah,
the
exactly.
control of it.
And often when they come to me in clinic, it's quite easy to rectify because it's like, well, yeah, you're just not eating enough.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
that's why you're not recovering. And actually, if we just change this and we add that and we make sure you do this and within a few weeks they're normally back on track and their performance is improving and everything's fine. The voluntary REDS is basically an eating disorder. It's where almost the expectation and the pressure of the competitive environment that they're in, and it's their own, it's not coming from anywhere else, it's how they've perceived it, it's their experience of it. That becomes too much for them to handle, and then they need some other way of dealing with that. And that's, I suppose, where food becomes the easy thing to focus on, because it's much easier to contain your emotions and contain those difficult feelings by restricting your diet. Yeah.
Interesting. So it's almost, I guess it's like any mental health issue. It's not about your sport. It's really about confidence and insecurity in a way.
Yeah.
Because if you're confident in what you do, you can be more objective, really, and you can realise, oh, okay, I might not win this race, but that doesn't mean that I'm not good.
Absolutely.
It just means I didn't win the race. So it's almost just trying to be more objective.
Absolutely. Completely. And I think, again, when you are in that very negative headspace, when you're low in self-esteem, you constantly compare yourself to other people.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, we both know there's no point comparing yourself to anybody else because there's no other person on this planet like you.
Yeah.
So what's the point? But yet... you do, and the difficulty is because of how you perceive yourself, you can't see yourself
in a realistic way. Yeah.
And so that comparison then becomes something that's not really real.
Mm.
It's very distorted in the same way that everything else is distorted. Your view of the world is distorted, and you start to believe your intrusive thoughts rather than asking questions and going, is that real, or is that just because... You know, like, I think we all have intrusive thoughts. I mean, I have them.
Yeah, of course.
But I will question, like, is that real?
Or is it just me feeling a bit shit?
Yeah, you know, so you question it. But I guess what I was coming back to was that when you don't have enough energy in the body, so when there's not enough energy in the body for your biological functions and your training, the body will always prioritise movement because of the way we've evolved.
Yeah.
So if you think about when we were hunter and gatherers, if you want to use that term, you know, we'd go through very long periods of time where we wouldn't have food, so our body would slow down our metabolism to preserve energy.
Yeah.
And then it would need to prioritise movement. If we saw something to go and hunt, we'd run to go and catch it. And then we'd fuel massively until... probably to excess, and then the body, you know, we'd go through those sort of cycles. And so our body's evolved to dial down our metabolism when it feels under stress.
Which is kind of reminding me of why crash diets don't work, exactly, right? Because a lot of people find that they gain weight. Is that right? Because their metabolism slows down so much.
Exactly. And I think the thing is, the thing that's really important to remember is that most people, most of us, and well, not always, but all of us, probably have a set weight range that our body is really, really comfortable at, and it operates brilliantly. And that range can be quite big. Like, it's not like, you know, it's not like 2 kilos or something. It can be like up to 10 pounds.
Yeah.
And you operate really well in that. And some people will be at the lower end of that, some people at the higher end of that, but that's where your body wants to be. And it will work really hard for you to maintain you there.
Yeah.
But what happens, and so when you crash diet, you basically, if you go much below the energy that you need, so when you go like, you know, these ridiculous diets that are 500 calories or 800 calories or whatever, you're going way below what your normal metabolism is just to keep
just
you alive.
Is that the basal
metabolism? Yeah. Right, yeah. And so the body just goes, well, hang on a minute, I'm in huge amounts of stress here, I cannot cope with this. And so it just slows your metabolic rate down, and you don't lose the weight that you think you're going to lose.
Yeah.
So what you initially lose is your glycogen stores and the fluid associated with that. So you think, oh great, this is working for me. But then normally after those first 6 pounds or so, those first 2 to 4 kilos that go off, then it slows right down and you think, well, this is not working anymore, so I'll cut down even more, and I'll cut down even more. But your metabolism is getting more and more
slow,
stressed.
Yeah.
And so what then happens is you just get to the point where you think, I can't maintain this anymore. So you people sometimes have a binge, or they just like, they go out somewhere and then they're just like, actually, I'm so hungry, I'm gonna just do it. And then the body will take on more fuel because it'll eat to excess.
Yeah.
Because it's like, well, I don't know when you're going to feed me again.
Yeah.
And so it will then, and that's why then people tend to start putting on weight.
Yeah.
So it's really important, if you are somebody that legitimately needs to lose weight, like legitimately, you need to be really mindful that you don't reduce your energy intake too far. And it is a question of kind of like increasing your exercise a bit and reducing your calories a bit.
Yeah.
But it's not, it's,
well,
not,
it's not increasing
masses.
The other. Yeah. But I think it's really interesting and like important for people to look at things like their basal metabolic rate. Mm. I've worked mine out, and I think basal metabolic rate is literally if you were to just lie down and do nothing. It's just so your body functions right. And I think for me, it's, I need like 1300 calories a day just to be alive without even moving, which I think is quite a lot.
Yeah.
And I think when you get factual about it and you see that, that's when you think, fucking hell, these diets are absolute bullshit, because
completely,
it's going against what your body needs to even function normally.
Completely. And I think the thing to remember is that actually probably 70% of our energy requirements a day is our metabolic rate.
Mm.
And then we have another sort of, you add another sort of 10 to 20% based on mobility. So that's just walking up and down the stairs, brushing your teeth, turning the kettle on, that kind of thing. And then up to 20% is used for digestion.
Yeah.
So when you eat food, you need energy to actually break that food down. And then the activity you do on top of that is additional.
Yeah.
So a lot of people don't appreciate that the majority of their calories that they take in is actually used to keep them alive.
Mm.
It's quite difficult to work out exactly what your metabolic rate is unless you're in a lab, because you do need to look at things like your lean muscle mass. And obviously everybody has a slight variation. Some individuals genetically will just have slightly higher metabolic rate than others, and that's related to genetics more than anything else. So that's another reason why I'm not a massive fan of things like calorie apps and things.
Because
all they do is take a weight and they base it on a weight, but they don't look at your body composition.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're somebody who does a lot of training, you might be quite lean. Mm. Like your body composition might be, you know, I don't know, for a female, maybe around 20%.
Yeah.
That's quite low for a female. But that's not taken into consideration. So you might have two women who are exactly the same weight, and one's got a body fat composition of 20%, and one's got a body fat composition of, say, 28%.
Mm.
And their metabolic rates will be different, but on an app, they'd be the same.
Yeah, because of the weight.
And I think that's, again, it's so important. And that's one of the reasons I'm really not a big fan of tracking and apps or anything. Because, again, people almost look at the body then as a machine.
Yeah.
Right? That it's like, oh, well, the app's told me I need this many calories, so if I put that in, that's what I need.
Mm.
Actually, our bodies are more like ecosystems
in
that they're constantly changing. The environment is constantly changing. And how do you know what you're going through. Like, how can you tell? Like, I know I've just been for quite a long run, so probably over the next 2 or 3 days my body's going to be doing a lot of repairing. But an app can't tell me that.
Yeah, we were just talking about this before we started, because again, I always come back to this, and I know it's a bit annoying, but I just, it's really what I believe, and that is, especially with women, we're cyclical, and you're not the same at the beginning of the month as you are at the end of the month. Like, you're almost four different people depending on what cycle you're at. Yeah. And I just think, yeah, the apps obviously dehumanize 100%. A little bit.
And I think the other thing, I mean, I've done a lot of seminars on this particular topic about how hormones impact what our body needs around training as well. So, like, you know, very loosely, I mean, I won't go into massive details, but in the sort of first, in the sort of follicular phase of your menstrual cycle, so when you're on your period to start with, and you're starting, and you just into ovulation, actually our bodies are much more stable in the sense that we don't crave food,
don't need
as much.
Extra energy, do you?
Exactly. And when you're training, you probably find that that's the best time to train, like, when you're more energized, when you can go out for longer runs, and I'm talking about running because I run, but you know what I mean, like, you can do a lot more and you can really push yourself quite hard. But then you get into the luteal phase, which is post-ovulation up to when you have your period.
Oh, the worst time of the month. I'm in that stage at the moment.
Exactly. Everything is awful. Like, and it's because progesterone and estrogen are rising. Yeah. And then you have this sudden drop when your period comes. But it's that rising that causes, it's particularly progesterone, it increases your need for energy, particularly carbohydrate and sugar. That is why we crave carbohydrate during this time.
So it's okay to have it if we crave it.
Yeah, no, honestly, I do think, like, so many women beat themselves up about not being able to stick to their diet when they're in that phase, and it's like, well, there's a reason, because your calorie requirements could be going up to 200 calories.
I just give in to it.
Yeah, me
too. It's so much easier to just give in sometimes than it is to try and be healthy. But would you say that for women around that, like, time of the month, not obviously it's, like, nice to, like, give in to a bit of chocolate or whatever, but is there other foods that can kind of satisfy us a bit more or are better for us at that time of the month? I'm really interested in this because I do succumb to family size bar of dairy milk, and I'll eat, like, one a day in, like, 30 seconds, and I know that it's, my body needs something, but I don't know what it is. So is there some, like, a particular food that's really good?
So what I tend to recommend is trying to keep your, but the reason why you're doing it is you need, blood sugars need to be stabilized.
Okay.
So trying to have good combinations of whole grains and protein regularly, like, probably even maybe more frequently than normal. So if you're normally a 3-meal-a-day type person, you might need 3 meals plus a couple of snacks.
Okay.
So things like, you know, dried fruit and some nuts are quite good because you've got a really good combination of whole grain or high fiber carbohydrate plus your nuts there to kind of stabilize. Or things like toast with peanut butter, for example, that sort of thing. So it's trying to eat more regularly and having a really good combination of carbs and protein, which
rather than waiting and then hitting yourself with loads of sugar. Okay, that makes sense.
So maybe not having big gaps, and particularly if you're training, the key thing will be really about carbohydrate availability. So really ensuring you're having good carbohydrate around. It's even more important in this phase than it is in the follicular phase, but having carbohydrate that is easily accessible. So you might find, like, when I'm in this phase of my menstrual cycle, I cannot ever do any training on just a banana.
Yeah.
I need to have, like, a hot cross bun instead of a banana. Whereas in the follicular phase, I could probably get away with having a banana and then go and do my run and then come back and have proper breakfast. So you have to, and again, I think we have become creatures of rigidity and
being the same way all
exactly.
the time.
And yet you're not. Like, nobody is the same weight every single minute of every single day, let alone every day. And, you know, I mean, I've spoken to your dad about this quite a lot. We talk about weight and clients quite often, and it's like it's helping them to understand that when you set somebody a target weight, in inverted commas, that's just an estimate, right? Like, nobody will be 54 kilos every single day. You might be 53.7 one day and 54.2 another day, or 54.6.
I saw a really good thing the other day where a woman weighed herself on 10 on the same day on 10 different scales, and the range of her weight was, like, completely different.
Yeah.
She was like, I don't know how much I fucking weigh, because each one tells me. I don't weigh myself maybe, like, every quarter. I don't have scales at home because I just don't care about, I just don't care. So it's always interesting for me when I weigh myself. But even then, I always like, is that my true weight? Because you never know.
Yeah, and I'm the same. I don't have scales, and I don't actually weigh my clients either.
Interesting.
Because I don't want people to be defined by a number.
And obviously the number is what's easy to measure, and then the restrictive behaviour.
Exactly.
I just want to go back to, this is more of a personal question that I want to know for myself.
Yeah, sure.
I want to know, in terms of exercise and like eating before exercise, because what you were saying about the cycles, I really relate to that. I find that the follicular phase you were talking about, I've got so much energy, and I personally, this might be a bit triggering for people listening, I personally don't like to eat before I exercise, and then I'll have a massive meal afterwards. But then when I'm in like this kind of stage of my cycle, I can barely get the energy to exercise, let alone like not eat without exercise. But I want to do what's healthiest. Is it okay to not eat before exercise?
So yes, but I'm going to put a disclaimer on it.
Yeah.
So basically, it's never okay to not eat if you're going to do a hard session.
Right. Okay.
So if you're going to do something really high intensity, like I know you do skipping and stuff.
Yeah.
I would not do that fasted at all.
Right, okay.
Right? If you want to go for a hike or an easy jog, or you're keeping your heart rate sort of around 60 to 70% of your max, or an exertion of, say, 6 to 7 out of 10, you can probably get away with that if you are somebody who is in normal weight and has a regular menstrual cycle.
Okay,
or
cool.
You know you have a regular menstrual cycle.
Yeah.
If you are somebody that is listening and you know that you have a difficult relationship with food, and you probably have a difficult relationship with training, and maybe you don't have a period at the moment, or you have irregular periods, that is a sign that your body is probably under stress.
Okay.
And in those cases, I never ever recommend doing fasted training. They do need to eat regardless of the intensity. And in fact, if you're not having periods, I would probably say you shouldn't be doing any intensity.
Yeah.
So it's a complex question to answer, because it depends on where you're at.
Yeah.
But so somebody like myself, I have been a normal weight forever, and I have a regular menstrual cycle. Generally speaking, I don't train fasted that often, just because I find that I don't feel as good when I'm exercising.
Yeah.
But what I eat will differ. So like some days it might just be that I will have a handful of nuts before I go to the gym and do some weights and stuff. Or like today I had a hot cross bun and then I went out and did quite a long run.
Maybe I should reword it, because you're saying fasted, and the reason I don't like to exercise after eating is can make me feel sick.
Mm-hmm.
So, and usually in the morning I'm in a rush, so it is... if I ate and then exercise, it would be close together.
Sure.
So maybe is it about eating something in the morning, waiting an hour or so, then going and doing it? Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's what I'll start doing then.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to...
Because you don't want to deplete yourself, but also you don't want to force yourself to eat if you're not hungry and it's going to make you feel sick.
True,
so.
But I think also just from a adaptation point of view,
yeah.
And this is really important, is that we do need a hormonal response to get adaptation. So if you think exercise is your stimulus, it's kind of like telling your body that it's doing something and that it wants to respond to that.
Mm.
But if you don't fuel that correctly, you won't get the growth hormone response that you need to adapt. So anybody, again, who doesn't have testosterone or estrogen in their body at the moment, is not circulated because they're overtraining and not fueling properly, they will not benefit from training.
Right.
They will not get an adaptive response. And so it's the same with high intensity stuff. If you're doing high intensity exercise and you're not eating, you won't benefit from that as much as you would if you did eat.
Okay.
So again, like what we find with athletes is actually when I've increased their energy availability and particularly their carbohydrate around their training, although they've been so fearful that they're going to put weight on, they don't, because again, they've dialed down their metabolism. They start eating, metabolism dials back up, and actually their body starts responding and they get leaner.
Yeah.
So I think
interesting.
Weight is not something I would use as a marker.
Yeah.
You know, like body composition, especially as an athlete, body composition is so much more important. But even that can be quite difficult with people who are, I guess, in a difficult headspace.
Yeah, definitely.
So I wouldn't do like skin folds for them. I wouldn't use calipers and measure it. I just do girth measurements.
Okay.
Because that gives us a good indicator of what's going on. Because you can be heavier, but your girth measurements are going down.
Yeah.
Because muscle takes up less space.
Yeah.
So it's heavier, but it takes up less space.
Yeah.
And so you have to be quite careful about that. And obviously it depends on where they are in their journey.
And also, if you're just somebody that exercises regularly or somebody that's, okay, I want to be an athlete.
Yeah, it's... completely. And I think there's a big discrepancy. Some people just exercise for health, and some people exercise because they've got a goal, and some people exercise because that's what they want to do.
Yeah.
That's their focus. But again, I think, and I've had this conversation with some, you know, really top coaches and people high up in the sporting world, I think we have to be really careful. Because when you think about the people that really made it big in the sports world, they're outliers, right? They're physiologically and genetically.
Yeah, they're the anomaly. Yeah. Anomalies.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, yes, we all might want to be the next Paula Radcliffe or the next Mo Farah or the next Jess Ennis. But we have to appreciate that we might not have the physiological makeup to do that.
Yeah.
And there needs to be some reality. We've got a dog.
We've got a dog choking on a hairball. Sorry. You okay, Ralph?
Yeah,
it's fine. Yeah.
So we have to be realistic. And it's not about being negative, but I think it's just getting people to understand. Because the problem is, what I see is that particularly young athletes, so between the ages of, say, 14 to about 18, you're physiologically developing. So you actually, and if you're new to a sport, you will do really well.
Yeah.
We all do really well when we first start a sport. You sort of see improvements.
Especially when you're really young.
Exactly. And so
almost
suddenly,
what you're built to do.
Completely. And then suddenly you're being told that you're really, really good. And if you focus on this, you can be the next best thing. And I'm not saying we shouldn't do that, but I think we have to be careful about the language we use.
Yeah.
Because again, as we went right at the beginning, you tend to be a certain type of person.
Mm.
And if that is then not managed well, that becomes what they work towards. That becomes their way of defining their worth.
Everything. Yeah.
Exactly. And I've got a lot of young, under 25-year-olds who've all been on the GB team at some time during, from about 18 up to 25. And a lot of them now have severe osteoporosis.
Oh my God.
Because they haven't managed themselves well. They haven't had the support they've needed. They've taken it and pushed it to a level because they believe they're the next best thing, but hasn't been... I mean, they are good, but it's like, where does it stop?
Yeah.
Like, and also, you've got to remember that an athletic career is long.
Mm.
And you have to consolidate. You have to let your body adapt and change. You go through phases. So you might go through a phase where you have some amazing results and then you might have to sit back and you might have to put some muscle mass on. But there's an in-between phase where you have to put weight on first and then put muscle mass on. So it's about being quite periodized and understanding that if you want it, you have to play the long game.
Yeah.
You don't get instant results.
And you can't do that without eating properly and being healthy.
And I think, unfortunately, we are a society that wants instant gratification.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
It's difficult.
What that reminded me of in terms of like being realistic is with social media, we see so many people that might have like the figures and bodies of like athletes. And I have a bit of a problem with Victoria's Secrets, the fashion show, because I used to love it when I was younger. About 10 years ago, it would be, well, for one, the models were a lot older, so they were like very womanly. And I know people are going to say, well, you know, a woman's a woman, but you know, traditionally womanly in terms of like being a bit meatier and having curves and stuff, and that's what they became known for. But because these women had like these naturally great bodies, it became a bit of a thing of like Victoria's Secrets models, they've got the best bodies. And now if you look at them, they look like athletes. They look like long distance runners and they're all working out and they do their videos. And I think it's just really unrealistic for people to try and do that because the way that they work out is like athlete standard and they get paid millions to do that. But that doesn't mean that you should work out like an athlete because A, you're not getting paid. So why would you bother like just to look like that? And also you're not 5'11" and you're not, your genetics aren't like that. So exactly. I think social media and just looking at images of those people who have that as a job is really damaging, I think.
100%. I mean, social media...
It's like love-hate.
Absolutely. Absolute love-hate relationship with it. Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. And it can be a great platform to educate, mm. but equally, when you're somebody that is insecure, has very low self-worth, you're going to use it to validate your worth and mm. validate what you want to believe. And yeah.
And it's all visual, isn't it? It's all images. So exactly. there's no other way apart from comparing physical exactly. things.
Completely. And you start, and I think also, I mean, we've had the thin ideal for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And I think it's become even more, like you said, visual. The visual content about the thin ideal is there. And like, you know, I remember, I've had clients come in and say, yeah, but you know, when you're thin, life's easier. And I'm like, really? I was like, really? You actually believe that? Like, where has that come from?
Because when I was younger, I was really, and I need to stress, I've never had an eating disorder, because I really haven't. I've got, like, you know, you've seen my mum. Yep. She's a skinny mini. It's in, like, my cousins are the same. My sister's the same. We're just tall and skinny. It's just our, and I hate the word skinny as well, tall and slim. And when I was younger, I was super, super slim, and people used to make comments and be nasty to me and accuse me of not eating. And it's interesting how when you're slim and you're thin that people point it out to you a lot. Yeah. Whereas if you're very overweight, people are very scared of mentioning that and you're not allowed to say it. So this idea that being thin is easier just doesn't make any sense to me, because I know a lot of people that are naturally slim and they would agree with me that yeah. you just get... It just gets brought up a lot, and it's not very nice, because yeah. it makes you think that that's all people see you as. It's like, oh, she's tall and slim. And it's like, well, I've got a lot more to offer than that.
Absolutely. And in fact, I remember one client in particular, she came in and probably this time last year, and she said, well, your life must be so easy because you're slim. And I'm naturally very petite. I've always been a very small person. Like, I've got very small bones.
Yeah, you're small.
And I said, really? I said, do you want to know what I've been through over the last 5 years?
Yeah, like, what's going on in my life?
Like, I've just been through a really difficult divorce. I've, you know, before that, my partner had a complete breakdown and couldn't work for a year. I've been bullied as a kid. I was beaten up because I was the only Asian kid around. I mean, you just name it. I've been, you think my life's been easy because I'm thin? Great.
Yeah.
Crap on. And she sort of looked at me and was like, oh, I didn't realise. And she said, but it's easy for you to find clothes in the shop. I said, no, it's not.
No.
And I've got lots of friends of different shapes and sizes. Mm. And we're all, I would put us all as slim.
Yeah.
But all different, because we all do different. But I don't know a single woman that goes to
the shop. I was about to say, is there anyone that finds...
it easy to find it? No. I mean...
I just need somebody, I need like my own personal couture designer to like made to measure stuff for me. Because
completely.
It's impossible.
Exactly. Because you're like, you're very, very tall.
Yeah.
I'm very, very small. And it's like... I can never find things to fit properly. Like, if they fit me, you know, in one place, they don't fit somewhere else. And it's like, oh my God. So yeah, it's really difficult.
Yeah.
Really, really difficult. And I think...
again, it's the focus on what you look like. And that's what's wrong with it, I think, isn't it?
Being defined by what you look like. And
yet,
the thing I try and teach people is that you are so much more than that. Like, for me, I don't really know what people see when they see me. But I don't really care. Because... mm. It's more about what I offer.
Yeah.
I know I'm a good person, and I know that I'm compassionate, and I know that I'm caring, and I'm a good friend, and I'm doing the best job I can at being a good mother, and all those different things. And that's so... I know I offer a lot.
Mm.
I'm
and
a
that's
package.
What's important.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What I look like is kind of really irrelevant in all that, from my point of view.
And that's just what you look like is what is just the sort of... oh, I don't know how to say it. It's like holding all of that together. It's just a shell almost,
absolutely.
Isn't it? Of
completely.
Like,
I always say it's a vessel, right?
Yeah.
And we're functional. But also, beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
Oh,
right?
Definitely.
So, like, everybody finds different things attractive. So you can't say, well, you need to be attractive, you need to be 5'9" with, you know, I don't know.
Blonde hair and blue eyed
exactly.
and big boobs
you
or whatever.
Because for some people, that is attractive. But for others, it's not.
Yeah.
And it's... and I always think attraction is something that grows, right?
Yeah.
It's like, yes, you might find somebody quite striking, but if you then, they don't have anything in common with you to converse with, then
there's
you sort
no
of go,
attraction.
Actually, I'm not really attracted to you. So I think, again, anybody who's listening who feels like it's so important to eat a certain way or exercise in a certain way or look a certain way. These are just things you're fixating on to help you, I guess, maybe because you don't feel comfortable with who you are, and it's much easier to kind of look
put it on something else,
you know, to project it onto something else. And yet, I'm sure, and the thing I always say is everybody offers something to someone.
Of course.
We all have an impact on the world in some way, and it's about understanding that you make a difference.
Mm.
You might not feel like you make a difference to, I don't know, a big audience. I mean, I'm always surprised when people say, oh, you know, what you said in your Instagram post made a real big difference. Or when you say, you know, your book, it's really helped me. And I think, I'm so pleased, because when I wrote it, I had no idea the impact it would make. Mm. But the fact
but not caring about that whilst you're writing it is what makes people like it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. Because fundamentally, I wrote the book because it needed to be written.
Yeah.
You know, it needed to be written. And sometimes people read your book, sometimes they don't. Sometimes people read a blog post, sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
Sometimes they listen to podcasts, sometimes they don't. But it's fundamentally, even beyond like those people you're making an impact on in the big bad world, you make a difference to people in your immediate circle.
Yeah, I think that's so important.
And you have to hold on to that.
And also concentrating on making a difference, even if nobody's listening or watching, or it's just constantly putting it out there.
Yeah.
Should we talk about the book, Orthorexia, which I've really read? Because there's a few things that I want to like, that sort of flagged up whilst I was reading it.
Sure.
It's what I want to say as well to people that haven't read it, because I think quite a few people that follow me on Instagram have. It's really easy to read, and there's not too much like annoying jargon in it. Like when you read it, it's almost like you're speaking rather than like, I don't know, it's just easy to read, and it's not like wanky nutrition talk. And it's not a very long book either, so it's like very, you just can just read it, like pick it up, put it down, read a bit more, and then it's done. So a few things that, these are real like mixed questions as well. So obviously the book's on orthorexia, which is the unhealthy obsession with healthy eating, nutrition. One thing that I think is probably like the overriding message from the book is like self-compassion, which I really liked that whole concept. Can you just talk about it in terms of like somebody that might have an eating disorder, or even like somebody that might just be punishing themselves a bit more? It doesn't have to be in an eating disorder way.
So I'm going to talk about it a little bit from myself,
because
I think it might help to explain it. So when my marriage broke down, I, as you can probably appreciate, was not in a particularly great headspace. And I beat myself up a lot. I beat myself up about the fact that had failed at something that I should have not failed at. I beat myself at the point at the fact that I might have caused a lot of stress to my children, and how are we going to cope. I beat myself about the fact that I had no idea how I was going to survive in terms of financially and a home, and so it was really, really difficult. And I've just kept beating myself up, like literally just cracking the whip and just being really just like, you're and all those intrusive thoughts just kept coming in. And I was like, but you can be so compassionate to the people you work with. Like, you can give them so much of yourself, and yet why can't you do that to you? And it was like, really, if you're going to teach people to be compassionate, you have to be compassionate to yourself. And it's the same thing. It's like, you suddenly realize that people who have a dysfunctional relationship with food or training or even just themselves, it's because they don't believe that they're good enough to take care of.
And that's what insecurity is, isn't it? Yeah.
And when you don't feel worthy of being loved or being looked after or getting help, like so many people I work with say, I don't want to come across as vulnerable or weak. And it's like, well,
why
not?
Exactly. But also, what's wrong with that?
Nothing.
You obviously are vulnerable and feeling a bit weak, because that's why you're here, kind of thing. And that's fine.
Yeah, 100%. And in fact, it was a post, and again, talk about Instagram, I think I wrote a post about being vulnerable and allowing myself to fall apart a little bit, because I kind of needed to rebuild myself.
Yeah.
And I started to look after myself, as in emotionally start to look after myself. I did things that I think I always was expecting other people to do for me.
Yeah.
So I started buying myself flowers. I started taking myself off for coffee dates. I didn't rely on people. I mean, I've got an amazing group of friends. I don't want people to think I'm on my own.
I've got
a fantastic group of friends, and they were always there for me. But I also knew I had to learn to be okay on my own.
Yeah.
And not wait for some hero to come
and sort it out for you.
Because that wasn't going to happen.
Yeah.
And I guess the thing is, when we don't feel good about ourselves, and when we've had an eating disorder, sometimes you get people who are waiting. They're waiting for this light bulb moment. They're waiting for somebody to come along and fix them.
Mm.
And nobody can fix you but you, because you have to realise that it's about how you perceive you and how you perceive life. You know, like, you have these food rules that are basically beliefs.
Mm.
And these beliefs have been created from information you've taken on, your experiences. So if you believe that carbohydrates are bad for you, that's what you fundamentally will believe.
Mm.
And that might have come from something, a source that you've read, and yet you're not questioning it.
Yeah.
But yet that belief system is creating a behavior.
It's instilled in you.
Yeah, and it's creating a behavior that's not healthy for you.
Mm.
Because there's nothing bad about carbohydrates.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's nothing bad about any one food group. It's, and I think that's what I've tried to get across in the book, is it is, unfortunately, that very boring term, moderation.
Yeah.
But it's about understanding that it is balance. And it's also not about, healthy eating is not about eating specific foods. It's about having a healthy
attitude. It's
about
eating all of them, isn't it?
Yeah. It's about having a healthy
attitude.
That's
what I got from the book.
Yeah. So, you know, I like croissants. So every now and again, I go through phases of eating quite a lot of croissants.
Yeah.
But that doesn't make me a bad person. And that's the other thing, is that people, they almost absorb what they're, like, if they think a food is bad and then they've eaten it, it's like, well, I'm a bad person.
I'm a bad person. And so there's that guilt and... Yeah,
exactly. But we're not bad people because we do something. Like, again, I felt like I'd failed at my marriage, but that didn't make me a failure.
Yeah.
It was just
it's almost like, not, I don't want to say disconnect from your feelings, but like disconnecting from back, like talking to yourself like
yeah,
that.
It's almost
treating yourself as another person. Like, how
exactly
would I act?
Yeah.
To my friend if she was like
exactly.
this.
Exactly. And I always talk about best friend thoughts.
Yeah.
So
you can either
choose to have intrusive thoughts.
Yeah.
And allow those to be what you focus on. Or you can go, do you know what? And this is what I had to do. I'm going to choose the thought that's got my best interest at heart.
Mm.
So I might feel right now like I'm not good enough. But the reality is, I know I'm good enough, because if I wasn't good enough, why would I have all these people that care about me
yeah.
wanting to help me?
Yeah.
And that's the problem. Feelings are important. Don't get me wrong.
Mm.
Feelings are important, but they're a barometer. They're telling us something's going on for us.
Mm.
And sometimes you have to look at that and go, what is real here? And what is it because I'm feeling a bit rubbish?
Yeah. That's what I mean by the like disconnect. It's trying to be objective with yourself,
yeah.
but obviously it's hard when it's an emotion.
Absolutely. And it's also when you're right in it, it's
yeah,
very
you
difficult.
Can't,
it's really hard.
You can't be objective.
No, it's really hard to know. And especially, again, if you then, on top of that, if you're somebody who's not eating properly.
You haven't got the right brain fuel.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I think what I liked about the self-compassion thing is that I feel like that's really what the true meaning of self-care is, because that self-care word is all over social media. And I remember when I first read it, that I actually really liked that term. I was like, that's a really good phrase to describe how to look after yourself. And it isn't just using a face mask or doing that.
Yes.
It is that, like, if a friend makes you feel a certain way because of stuff that they're doing, then don't be friends with them, which is difficult. But in the long run, that's better for you. So I think that's why I liked the word self-compassion, because it's a bit more fitting and
exactly,
less cringy.
Completely. And it is about looking at, what is it you're going to do today that's for you?
Mm.
You know, like, and sometimes it is a physical thing, like I said, buying flowers or whatever.
Yeah.
But sometimes for me it was actually, do you know what, I'm going to turn my computer off and I'm going to sit on the sofa and just allow myself to
yeah.
feel whatever it is that I need to feel. And if I need to feel sad, that's okay. It was
yeah.
like allowing myself to be a human. Like, if I wanted
yeah.
to cry,
just cry
and grieve the loss of my marriage or grieve whatever, then I could. And even now I'm really good at kind of going, do you know what, I still feel a bit, I mean, I'm great now, my life is back on track and things are good, but I still have days, I've had days recently where I've just felt really sad,
yeah,
and I haven't been able to understand why, but I've just gone, do you know what,
just gonna feel sad,
just gonna go with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, that's a really important message, I think. And it's one that even though everybody that I've interviewed so far is so different, it's the same thing that they keep coming up with, which, I mean, it's the truth. So, complete tangent, food combinations.
Yep.
You talk about this in the book in terms of, like, carbohydrate, what is good. I think you talked about having, like, a bit of carbohydrate with protein. I know nothing about food combinations at all. Can you just, like, briefly or, like, group a few things that are good to have together and sure. why that is?
Sure. So,
and I'm just going to check on Ralph because he's stopped taking his heart medication. So
he's on the floor.
He's alive. Okay,
yeah, he's
fine.
Good.
And he's just weed on the floor over here as well.
Nice.
So he's all good. So food combinations. I think you were talking about it for breakfast, maybe carb mix, like having a bit of carbohydrate and protein, and why that's good.
So I think the thing to remember is that again, carbohydrate has had a really bad press, right? And people are fearful of it. It's like. And they're only accepting of certain carbs. Well.
Yeah.
So for a long time, the only carbohydrates that were acceptable were oats and sweet potato.
Yeah.
Because that's what the kind of influencers allowed you to believe was okay to eat. And yet all carbs are equal, right? In that per gram of carbohydrate, it's 4 calories.
Okay.
That's it.
And it doesn't matter what carbohydrate is. Okay.
If you look at pasta, right, like something that's, I mean, it's difficult because not all food is pure carb, but things like your pasta, your rice, bread, potatoes, you know, they are pure carbs.
Okay.
Right? So they're all the same. So per 100 grams, they would give you about the same calories, but they're all going to be different in that 100 grams is quite a different portion for each.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
Right?
Yeah.
And there is you know, obviously we knew that certain carbs are... more easy to digest. So things like your white carbohydrates, they can be easier to digest. Now, sometimes you need that, particularly if you're doing a lot of sport, you might need that because you don't want to necessarily feel really, really full.
Mm.
Like if you have a whole grain version, because of the fiber content, you're going to feel much fuller and it's going to be a lot slower at releasing energy. So for the normal everyday person who's not an athlete, you do want to base your meals as much as possible on whole grain carbohydrates. So that's your whole grain breads, things like your whole grain pastas, rices, couscous, quinoa, you know, all those things. And you want to try and have a good portion of that at least 3 times a day. You might need more depending on your activity levels, but at least 3 times a day. And then, again, you want to combine that with things like protein and essential fats because that makes your diet much more balanced. So, you know, your protein could be eggs, it could be Greek yogurt, it could be chicken, fish, if you're a vegetarian, it could be things like tofu, beans, that kind of thing. But also remembering that vegans and vegetarians need to be more mindful of how they combine proteins to get full proteins.
Okay.
And then essential fats, again, we know that, you know, there is still very much that we want to keep saturated fat as a minimum.
Okay.
I'm not saying you should never have it, but you want to keep it as a minimum.
What food example is that?
So that tends
Don't say
to
butter.
Be... So yeah, it does tend to be things like butter and the fat on meat.
Okay.
But we're still talking about minimum, right? We're not talking about, like, I eat butter. I choose butter over margarine because I prefer it.
Yeah.
I just don't eat half a pack of butter every day. I'll eat some on my toast or on my potatoes or whatever.
What about the whole fat thing in terms of fat is good and the research against, like, carbohydrate and... for a higher fat diet?
So that research that was done is absolutely flawed.
And research?
So there was some research that came out in the BMJ about 18 months ago that said that we should all be eating higher fat, lower carb diets, and that was better for your heart health, and the whole saturated fat thing was a whole lie, and we should not
be.
Well, the group of people that actually did that research were flawed in what they did. And recently, the BMJ actually sent out a bit of an apology and has rectified that. And we do know that saturated fats are still a concern.
Okay.
So they still need to be kept as a minimum. I'm not saying you should avoid them, but they need to be kept as a minimum. But we also do know that good fats, so your non-saturated fats, so things like your avocados, your oils, your seeds, your nuts, oily fish, those are all actually really good for us. And we should be eating a higher percentage of those because they also keep us full, and they've got essential fatty acids, which are really important for our heart health and our cognitive health. The one kind of exemption to the high fat, the sort of saturated fat, is dairy, okay. which has been found to actually be beneficial to your heart health. So again, the saturated fat, fatty chains...
Is butter dairy or not?
Not really, okay. No. But the saturated fatty chains and things like your yogurt, your milk, cheese, they actually seem to be protective over heart health.
Mm.
So I'm a big fan of dairy, and I do get like a lot of abuse for being a big fan of dairy.
Yeah.
But I will always look at science, and I will always provide advice based on science. Mm. Now, I appreciate that there's a whole ethical side of dairy
yeah.
that people are uncomfortable with, and that's fine. If that's your reason for not wanting to eat dairy, so be it.
But not because you think it's bad for you.
No, yeah. exactly. And it goes back, it's the same with like the whole sustainability thing. I am so sick of people telling me that plant-based milks are more sustainable than dairy. Well, actually, if you live in the countryside, like we live really close to so many farm shops mm. right here down in Bath, and I'm in Bradford-Avon, yeah. actually getting milk from there
is more sustainable. Is
more sustainable than you buying almond milk from the shop.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I get really cross when people use that, again, they use veganism as a means of being more sustainable, because actually you can be, being sustainable is about choosing foods that are more local
to you, yeah, yeah.
and in season.
Yeah.
They're not about buying avocados that have been shipped across the world from the Amazon rainforest. Yeah. You know, they're not about, that's yeah, yeah, not yeah. sustainable. So I think people, and also it really annoys me that the people that bang on, sorry, I'm a bit
it's all right, go for it.
The people that do bang on about sustainability, they also tend to be the ones that have got two cars, two yeah. big cars, and they travel on many holidays yeah. a year. That's
well, it's cherry picking, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think we have to be really careful about kind of pigeonholing things.
Yeah.
So from my point of view, a balanced diet is one that contains all food groups, including sugar. Mm. And again, interestingly, like if you
this look is at one the, of the Instagram questions, by the way.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. Including like, so there is obviously, we do have a scan report which says about sugar, only added sugar. So added sugar is the sugar that's not in, it's not in fruit and it's not in milk.
Okay.
Okay, so it's anything additional.
Added, yeah.
So it's things like your table sugar that everybody is so fearful of, honey, molasses, date syrup, maple syrup, mm. Rice syrup, what have I missed? Brown sugar. I mean, it's, yeah. sugar is sugar.
Yeah.
Okay, that's really important to understand. So when...
Because the question was, how bad really is sugar?
So personally, we don't have... There is no absolute study that has said that sugar causes obesity or sugar mm. causes any sort of illness. There is no study that proves that at all. But it is very easy to overconsume sugar. Yes, we do know that. And obviously things like sugar, especially in things like sugary drinks,
yeah.
can be very easy.
You well, they're take just on, easy yeah, to... Yeah.
Exactly. So this is where this whole report came through, was that we do want to reduce the amount of fizzy drinks available, because that's a very easy way, particularly children, to absorb sugar without really thinking about it.
Yeah. I think it definitely messes up your palate as well when you overconsume sugar.
Yeah.
I would know this because I do overconsume yeah. sugar, and then I have to like cut it out and then build it back up, and it definitely like mutes your palate in some yeah. ways. Like you, yeah, I don't know.
And the guidelines suggest that that we should have no more than 5% of our mm. Energy intake should be sugar, added sugar.
Added sugar, yeah, yeah.
Added sugar. That said, there's a really good study that shows that really the problems with sugar occur when it is contributing to 20-25%
okay.
of your overall energy intake. So when I think about food and I think about my diet, I always think, I don't ever deprive myself of sugar. I mean, I eat chocolate every day because mm. it's a necessity as far as I'm concerned
yeah.
to get me through my day.
Yeah.
But I do know that my intake of sugar is
less than 25.
Yeah. It's the smallest contributor to my overall intake of everything else.
Okay, cool.
Most of the time.
Yeah.
There are odd days when it's not.
Where it's like
yeah.
100%.
Yeah. Exactly.
So, should we quickly do the Instagram questions? That was one of them.
Yeah.
How bad really is sugar? Somebody has asked, what foods/vitamins should I be consuming if I suffer from eczema or dry skin?
Okay. So, I mean, eczema and dry skin can be, as you know, can be a lot of things.
Yeah.
Not necessarily food related.
Yeah.
It can be a sign, particularly dry skin, can be a sign of two things. One, hormonal control.
Okay.
So definitely if you're somebody who, I mean, I don't know,
yeah.
But if you're somebody
I can't remember who sent it to me either, actually, so I'm not sure.
But if you're somebody that maybe is slightly restrictive of your eating, you may be being over-restrictive, which is causing you to have dry skin.
Okay.
Or if you are just somebody who has dry skin and you're normal weight and everything's fine,
yeah.
It could be that you're not getting the balance of your N3 fatty acids and your N6 fatty acids.
Okay.
So we all eat quite a lot of N6 because we get it through seeds and nuts.
Yeah.
But we don't eat enough N3, which is mainly your oily fish.
Okay.
And the only sort of plant-based sourced is things like walnut oil.
Okay.
And walnuts and flaxseed, but you have to have quite a lot.
A lot to...
So you might find that you need to take a supplement.
Okay.
I'm not a big fan of supplements.
Okay, this is the next question is supplements, because I've heard... One argument saying the food that we have is so nutritionally deprived and the soil is so shit that we should be taking supplements. The other thing is that our body doesn't know how to take the vitamins or minerals from the supplement in that form.
Yeah.
So what's the deal on that?
So I'm not a big fan of supplements.
Okay.
Because, yeah, the bioavailability of supplements is quite poor.
Okay.
And even if you buy a really expensive one,
yeah,
it's poor. Because our body, like, so for example, I've got a lot of people that have anemia, so low iron levels, and they're put on
those basic iron tablets.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it's known, it's so well documented that iron, so ferrous sulfate, which is the traditional thing that's prescribed and used, is not good for the gut and is not easily absorbed. So I tend to always say to my clients, when you get a prescription for iron, ask your doctor to prescribe you with ferrous fumarate in a liquid form, because that is much more easily absorbable. So sometimes we do have to take supplements,
yeah,
because our iron levels are so low, we have to. When it comes to other supplements, the only time I would do it if somebody's diet was really very poor, or they weren't getting enough energy in overall, if they had a history of an eating disorder or say alcoholism or depression, I'd look at their overall intake,
okay,
of nutrition. Or if they had somebody who had bone health issues, again, you'd need to think about calcium.
Boosting
and
up
vitamin.
The
and then the
okay.
other one that we should all be taking is vitamin D.
Yes.
And I do take that myself. It's
okay.
The only supplement I take personally is vitamin D.
That's really important for women's health as well, isn't it?
Really important for lots of things. So vitamin D is really important for your bone health. It's also really important for muscular recovery from exercise. It's really important for your mood, and it also helps to regulate your weight. So it's a very, very important hormone for all of us, vitamin for all of us. And I know that my vitamin D levels run really low. So I had mine done a few weeks ago and it's still only 32. And we should be, especially when you're physically active, you want it to be about 90.
Wow.
So I take quite high doses at the moment, because even though the sun is out today, we know
it's
that
not.
In this country it's not always out. And even when it's out, we're not out in it.
Yeah,
so,
like right now.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you think, what's your heritage?
So both my parents are Indian.
Okay. So do you think, because I feel like this because obviously dad is Spanish.
Yeah.
Do you think people that are like half another race or nationality that comes from a sunny country, do you think that we suffer more?
I think that's a really good question.
Because I think I do.
I feel
like I'm meant to be in the sun.
Possibly. I know that I struggle because of two reasons. One, because I'm dark skinned.
Yeah.
And secondly, because I actually have an autoimmune condition that I know drains my vitamin D.
Right.
So there's a couple of reasons that are going on for me. But definitely the more dark skinned you are, and I don't mean necessarily just like, you know, as in, but even like you're quite olive toned.
Yeah.
So the darker skinned you are, the more vitamin D you do need.
Yeah, that makes sense. Another question was foods to maybe have or avoid for hypothyroidism.
Okay, so if you have hypothyroidism...
Which is under, isn't it?
Under,
hypo,
under,
yeah.
Yeah, under, so under kind of the thyroid is not working, not producing thyroxine, you're probably on thyroid medication.
Okay.
And if you're on thyroid medication, then technically you should then be back to a normal, even keel.
Right.
So there's no foods you should really avoid. And like I said, if it's managed well, then you'll probably find that your weight and everything is stabilized. What normally happens is sometimes people can put on quite a lot of weight in the prior to diagnosis,
okay,
because obviously the thyroid is not working very well, yeah, and your metabolism is slowed right down, and that's when you put weight on. So there's no real food. Like, I know there's some wacky blogs and vlogs out there that say you should remove gluten.
Yeah,
but there's no but there's no evidence for that at all. So I again would say it's more about a balanced diet, making sure you've got plenty of colours in your diet. You know, sorts of, you know, lots of different coloured vegetables and fruit, whole grains, pulses, good sources of
And would you say that just for everyone?
Yeah,
yeah.
And it's just the amounts that are different depending on what you do.
Yeah.
You know, like depending on how busy you are and how physically active you are.
Okay. And I know that this, you probably get asked this a lot, but I'm always interested in like people's personal like opinions.
Yeah.
If there was a food that everybody had to eat every day for health reasons, what would it be?
Oh my goodness, that's a really good
question. What do you have? Because I've got my one, which is and it's just because it's my favourite fruit, but I eat a red grapefruit every single day.
What do
because
I
just feel like it really benefits me. Everyone says fucking broccoli, don't say broccoli.
No,
please.
No,
all the health podcasts say broccoli.
My best friends would say almond butter for me.
Yeah.
Because I can't live without almond butter.
Okay.
And there's, I mean, it's a great source of nutrition.
I've got
right?
mum onto almond butter actually, instead of having sweet treats. I was like, just have a little teaspoon of almond butter. Because it almost sticks your mouth together as well, so that you don't want to eat anything
else. It's really high in calcium,
yeah.
It's really high in iron. It's high in selenium. It's obviously got essential fatty acids in there. I mean, I can overeat it quite massively, but I love it. And
okay.
So for me, I would probably say I find it very difficult not to. When I go away sometimes and I don't have it for a few days, like when I come back, I'm a nightmare.
Okay.
So, but yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any particular anything else that I feel like I would need to live by. I mean, I'm quite varied in my diet. I eat differently most days depending on
what's going on. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, cool. And then I want to ask you, just to wrap up really, because we've actually covered so much, what does health mean to you personally? So let's just start with that one, and then I'm gonna, and then professionally as well, because I think maybe they might be different.
Yeah, I mean, so for me personally, being healthy, and I'm not doing a great job of it at the moment, is actually getting a really good work-life balance.
Okay.
And I'd say I probably haven't done very well at that in the last few years. I'm working towards it, because I think what I find, I love my job, I love working with people, and I give a lot of myself to people. But what I'm realising is I'm not giving myself enough time to replenish so that I can continue to help people. And I think some of that is about me being more boundaried in the sense that I need to not answer everything on Instagram and not respond to every email when it comes through, and just have some very clear cut-off times. Because I'm so keen to help as many people as possible, sometimes I probably have done that.
It's a trait of, I think, just, I have the same with like massage as well. And I know both my parents have the same with therapy. If you're in that type of business, you tend to be somebody that wants to help more.
Yeah.
But that's where you just end up ill, don't you?
Exactly.
Yeah. And so looking after yourself as well.
Yes. I think that for me, that's at the moment, that's
your
thing. My focus about health is to look after me. And I'm not, I haven't, and I'm going to put my hands up, I haven't done a very good job of that. Probably in the last few years, if I'm honest.
Okay.
And professionally, being healthy actually, I think, is about having a healthy attitude towards eating and not feeling like there are good foods and bad foods. Like, as soon as food creates an anxiety, I think that's a problem.
Okay.
And so it's about trying to not have food rules. We don't need them. Like, you've created them.
So that's just reminded me, because I know that you see a lot of people that have cut out complete food groups.
Yeah.
Have you ever, and I think it can be quite scary for somebody that has got an allergy, like the thought of maybe reintroducing that into their diet. Have you had any clients that have been on really strict things because of allergies and then have managed to eat those foods and not have reactions and be healthy again. So yeah. Like somebody that might cut out the standard ones, gluten and dairy,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, lots of people.
You've had success stories in that way.
I think firstly, it's really important to understand that when you cut out a food group and you might not have needed to, or because, you know, you've just done it because it's a belief system, a fear or whatever, you down-regulate your body's ability to actually cope with that food.
Right.
Which is why when you then maybe try and eat it, you immediately think, oh,
get
my God,
ill again.
I've got,
yeah.
You know. So I've got a really interesting case at the moment where a really lovely young woman, she's had a really tough time and she's had an eating disorder, she's had lots of support and professional help, and she had an inpatient stay, came out of that, and was experiencing some real extreme pain, probably as a result of basically her immune system being under attack because her body had been so unwell for such a long time. And she went to see, and I'm putting this in inverted commas, a nutritionist who wasn't qualified to be a nutritionist, in Harley Street, who basically said, well, you need to take out all these different foods. So she literally was living, I mean, firstly, if you are a qualified individual working in nutrition,
you wouldn't say
you
that
wouldn't
to somebody.
Say that to somebody who's just had an eating disorder and come out of an inpatient setting, because that's just ridiculous.
Nuts.
And the whole point of working with people with eating disorders is you have to get them balanced. Like, it's not about eating in a particular way. It's actually about accepting everything. So, and I think that's why it's so important for people to understand that actually, if you've got an eating disorder, it's a clinical condition, and dietitians are the only regulated nutritional practitioner
that
to
can
work
help you
in that clinical setting. Nutritionists, even regulated, even registered nutritionists, should not be working in eating disorders because they don't have the clinical background, and that's just just the choice of degree they've done. That's it. They just don't do the clinical placements that we do. So this young woman, basically, she's been to see lots of people since, and she's started working with me about 8 weeks ago. And she said to me, I know that I need to kind of challenge these things, but I'm so fearful of pain and problems. And I said, well, you know,
and the reactions that you might have.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I said, the difficulty is obviously because you have a belief system around it, you're probably going to
believe
feel.
That it's going to happen.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, we're going to have to do this really slowly. And it's not about going cold turkey and starting to introduce like a piece of bread straight away. It's about having something that might contain gluten first. And, you know, maybe that's unintentional, but it's about having that and then realizing, oh, nothing awful's happened. And then you might have something that's got a bit more gluten in it, and so on. So you build up the dose so the body then can start to really. I've had individuals who go, I want to eat pasta again, and then they've just gone out mass pasta, and of course they've had.
I mean, I don't think I've got an intolerance to gluten, but even if I eat a bowl, big bowl, anybody, that's going to happen, isn't it?
Yeah, and so I think the other thing to remember is that just because you feel bloated after eating pasta, it doesn't mean you have a problem with it, because let's face it, it's a carbohydrate. And the one thing that carbohydrate does is keep you full. And it holds fluid. So we're meant to feel full after it. We're meant to feel bloated. And it's like, it sometimes feels like people are, I don't want to feel full. I don't want to feel bloated. And it's like, but that's what we're meant to do. So I think when somebody has had, they've been eliminating food for a long time and they don't really know they should be or not, the way to do it is to reintroduce, but very, very slowly and gradually. And it's a small dose by dose response. It's not a, right, I'm going to eat a, you know, a piece of bread or drink a glass of milk. It's slowly. And with this girl particularly, we started off with sort of titrating her milk.
So it was tiny.
And then, you know, recently she went out with some friends and she had a latte, and she's like, they ordered it for me and I wasn't sure, but actually I was fine.
She was fine. Well, then it goes to show a lot of the time it's mind over matter, isn't it? Like, if somebody that was super allergic or said that they were super allergic and they had it without knowing, it would be interesting to see who noticed it or not. It's like a placebo. The last thing was, I just wanted you to just tell everybody about the clinic in Bath. Because it's like your new project. I thought it'd be good to finish up on.
So I have just...
where people can find you and all that kind
I've
of thing.
I've just joined forces with Dr. Nikki Key, who is a sports endocrinologist to be fair, we've been working together for about a year, but we've been into referring to each other and supporting individuals together, but kind of it's been more clunky, in that they come to me and then I send them to Nikki and then Nikki sends them back to me. So we just thought, actually, you know, it'd be great. I've always wanted to open a centre or somewhere, centre of excellence, best practice, to help people, particularly those individuals that are affected by difficult relationships with food and training. I want them to have a place where they can come in, and it's a bit like a garage. They come in,
have
and
an MOT.
We do it all. So we have just set up the Inspire Clinic, which basically stands for Endocrine Nutrition Specialist Practitioners in Restoring Equilibrium. So we're trying to get people to be balanced. So we've opened at the Pure Practice in Bath, which is St. James's Buildings. And we're working collaboratively with, obviously, the Pure Practice, which is a physio practice, and Strength and Endurance, which is a S&C service as well. So it's great. So we've had a couple of athletes now who've come in, who've had a really difficult time. We've done full bloods to see what's going on. From the bloods, Nikki has been able to sort of say, you know, you've got functional hypothalamic amenorrhea, or in men, you've overtrained and testosterone is really low, so that's why you're not getting results. Or this is why you've had stress fracture after stress fracture. And we have then been able to put plans together, so both nutritional plans and behavioural plans, but also some strength plans to help get them back on track, so that when they go back into their sport, regardless of what level they are, they go back as robust and resilient individuals who don't just put a sticky plaster over something and then come back again. So we're really changing
educating.
The scene. And this is the first of its kind in the country. So we're really, really excited. And we've just been so excited by the response we've had and the number of people that have booked in already.
Yeah.
To the point that already, even though we only launched 2 weeks ago, we are planning on opening the same Inspire Clinic but in London.
Oh, cool.
Probably by the end of May.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah. So it's busy.
So work life balance is out the window.
Exactly.
But that's so exciting.
Yeah, really exciting.
And where can people find you?
So the best place to find me is on my website, which is just easy, reneemcgregor.com. If you want to follow me on Instagram, you can. I'm r_McGregor. And that's probably the two best places.
Cool.
Because you can contact me through the website.
Yeah. And read the books as well, because they're
the
really
books.
Interesting. I think even if you're not like an athlete, it's just good to know.
Yeah.
Cool. Thank you so much. I just want to carry on talking. I've got so many questions. But I hope that's been helpful for people. And yes, thanks for listening.